Hi, good afternoon. I have the distinct honor of introducing our guest speaker. Okay. Dr. Joe Schwartz is director of McGill University's Office for Science and Society. He is well known for his informative and entertaining public lectures on topics ranging from chemistry of love to the science of aging. Professor Schwartz has received numerous awards for teaching chemistry and for interpreting science for the public. He is the only non-American ever to win the American Chemical Society's prestigious Grady Stack Award for demystifying chemistry. He hosts the Dr. Joe Show on Montreal's CJAD and Toronto's CFRB, and has appeared hundreds of times on the Discovery Channel, CTV, CBC, TV Ontario, and Global Television. Dr. Schwartz also writes a newspaper column entitled The Right Chemistry. He's authored a number of books, Radar, Hula Hoops, and Playful Pigs, The Genie in the Bottle, That's the Way the Cookie Crumbles, Dr. Joe and What You Didn't Know, The Fly in the Ointment, Let Them Eat Flax, An Apple a Day, and Brain Fuel, all of which have made it onto the bestseller list. He's also an amateur conjurer and often spices up his presentations with a little magic. We're all here today to share a little of Dr. Joe's passion for scientific curiosity. And as he wrote in his book, Brain Fuel, my hope is that I can kindle that spark into a roaring flame. It should get very warm in here. Dr. Joe.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I have to tell you that of all of those things that I do, maybe what I enjoy the most is talking to the McGill community, whether it's students or colleagues, because it kind of feels like you're playing a home game. And that's always more fun. Well, as you probably know, our office is dedicated to demystifying science. And one of the best areas to use as an example where demystification is needed is in the area of what we call alternative medicine. The name itself is confusing, isn't it? What is it an alternative to? An alternative to evidence-based medicine? Well, that wouldn't make much sense, would it? So what is an alternative to? I don't know. It's very hard to come up with a proper definition of this. In my view, medicine either works or it doesn't. If it works, it isn't alternative. If it doesn't work, it isn't medicine. So what are we talking about? Well, let me try to give you an idea of what we're talking about. We're talking about stuff that we don't teach up the hill here. That's really, I think, the common understanding of what alternative is. It's not because it is, by definition, wrong or nonsensical. It's just there isn't yet enough evidence for it to fuse it together with the other stuff that we do teach in medical school. Because we are, in medical school, kind of hung up on a little thing that we call evidence. We like to impart that to students. Whereas when it comes to a great deal of the alternative area, it's based on hearsay, on wishful thinking, anecdote, flim-flam. Now, all of this stuff ranges between reasonable and the totally absurd. For example, many herbal remedies like St. John's wort, very, very reasonable for mild depression. On the other hand, urine therapy is totally unreasonable, and yet it is very real. There are people who believe that consuming one's urine is the key to good health. They write articles about it, books about it, and they have conferences dedicated to it, world conferences, where you can refresh yourself with the product in question. And it does seem funny, doesn't it? But I assure you, this is absolutely real. And when you speak to these people, they are dedicated and believe that this is the answer to their problems. There are many other areas of so-called alternative medicine, some of which I think are probably familiar to you. Many are not. We do a whole course on alternative medicine, of course, in med school, so it's impossible to encapsulate it all in the short time that we have. So I'll just try to give you a few representative examples. I think what really links all of these together is the lack of evidence of efficacy. Because as soon as you have enough evidence, the alternative becomes conventional. It's not true that scientists are constantly wearing blinders and not ready to accept new ideas. Not the case at all. The only thing we say, let's see the evidence. And when the evidence comes, it is embraced. To give you an example, when Dr. Barry Marshall first suggested back in 1983 that helicobacter pylori was the cause of ulcers, he basically was laughed at, right? And he had to take matters into his own hands, in fact, into his own mouth. In a silly way, he decided to prove his point by consuming the bacterium to show that he developed an ulcer. Not the best scientific method, but he did. He did, and then he showed that he cured himself with an antibiotic. Okay? However, within a decade, this was widespread practice around the world. So when something is shown to be true, it is very readily accepted. You see, the alternative community constantly points to things like this and say, you see, you guys, your scientists said it was nonsense and it turned out to be true. Well, when it turns out to be true, we embrace it. The fact is that most things that seem like nonsense are nonsense. This is the exception. And, of course, together with Dr. Robin Warren, he was a very deserving winner of the Nobel Prize. Today, triple therapy, as it is called, against Helicobacter, is the standard medical care. But in the alternative arena, what they do is just speak to each other through their alternative magazines, which are not scientific journals. And the same ideas are being debated that have always been debated, with very, very little progress. As soon as they publish something in the peer-reviewed literature, and it's accepted, of course, it crosses that bridge from alternative into proper conventional care. But amazingly, there are more visits to alternative practitioners in North America than to conventional physicians, which is a very interesting observation, and there are more dollars spent on so-called alternative care. If there was a redistribution of that amount of money, we would dramatically reduce our problems with the conventional system if those billions and billions were not spent on fruitless endeavors, because that is basically what it amounts to. So why does it happen? Why do patients use alternative medicine? There's dissatisfaction with the efficiency of conventional medicine. People look around and say, look, we've gone to the moon. You go on your computer, you put in a keyword, you get 2 million hits on Google within half a second. Look at this technology. It's fantastic. How come that we haven't had the same kind of progress in cancer treatment? How come that since President Nixon declared a war on cancer, we've hardly won a battle? Well, actually, it's not true that we've hardly won a battle, but we've not seen the dramatic progress we'd like to see. The truth of it is that going to the moon and Googling are child's play compared to what happens in the human body. It's just far more difficult to solve these kind of problems. What people expect it, and they say, okay, well, we must be barking up the wrong tree. That's why we haven't seen the results. Let's go the alternative route. There's, of course, dissatisfaction with the hurried approach that many doctors have to take today. That's because of the confines of our medical system. And there just isn't the time to spend hours with a patient, which is really what should be done, to take proper care. It just doesn't work that way, but the alternative practitioners do have the time to spend. And, of course, there's the distrust of big pharma, which is becoming a snowballing effect. It's amazing how big pharma has become the big devil. Now, I think none of us are naive enough to think that there are no skeletons in Big Pharma's closet. Of course there are. It's a money-making industry. It's not a philanthropic enterprise. So, of course, there will be issues. But the fact is that the way that you make money, the way that you profit, is by selling effective, useful drugs in the long run. You don't make money by killing off your customers. You don't make money if you're going to be sued, as is the case in the U.S., you know, for virtually every misstep. So it isn't true that they are just callously putting substances on the market. Maybe they're not the most altruists, but they know the bottom line. And the bottom line is that you make money by selling good products for which you're not going to be sued. And then, of course, there's the belief that somehow natural healing methods are superior, that if you just give nature the right weaponry, it will heal all diseases. Well, I don't think I have to discuss this too deeply. It is demonstrably not true. You just cannot rely on nature to heal everything. But the key to the alternative medicine popularity is the charisma of the provider. They are very nice people, usually believing wholeheartedly in the trade that they ply, although sometimes self-delusional. And, of course, the key is the faith of the patient. The idea that someone is willing to take care, wants to discuss every aspect of your life, and really cares. That's why people like Andrew Weil have become superstars, to lead us out of the wilderness. And he's a very nice guy, very interesting guy. He's a Harvard-trained physician, and now, of course, he's into everything natural. I can tell you we're roughly the same age, and I used to meet him at conferences back 35 years ago, and Andy was into everything natural back then, too. If you could smoke it, you smoked it. And even back then he was saying that, you know, this was the area that eventually would be profitable. This was the niche, natural treatments. Now, many of the things that he says are perfectly legitimate. But he knows, being a properly trained physician, he knows when to recommend milk thistle and when to send someone to the oncologist. Okay? Now, of course, when you listen to his persona on TV, which is the character that he plays, everything is natural and herbs. Fact is, 90% of his practice is conventional medicine, but that's, of course, not where he gets his popularity. And there is, of course, something to these treatments. Milk thistle may have something, but not a whole lot. It's been looked into. It's been researched. And the studies contradict the things that Andy says. But, you know, people aren't interested in that. They're interested more in the magical thinking. I'm interested in the science behind it, and that's why I tend to be critical, certainly not unaccepting. I would just like to see what the science is. What is the truth? And that's why I have concerns about alternative medicine, because I think it does misrepresent conventional medicine. Their spokespeople do. I think that they do introduce pseudoscientific ideas. I think often they misrepresent the efficacy of their own treatment and safety. They steer people away from possibly effective treatments, and in many cases, it is just a gigantic waste of money. I want to give you a couple of examples here. So let's look first at the misrepresentation of conventional medicine. I'm sure you've all seen books like this. They show up with regularity in our mailboxes, books, brochures, about how modern medicine is killing us, and that all modern doctors do is they cut, they burn, and they poison you if you have some kind of devastating illness such as cancer, whereas, of course, all of the natural therapies are benign and, you know, don't do anything like that. They offer treatments that organized medicine is trying to hide. Why? Because, of course, they're scared for their bottom line. This is an argument you hear over and over again, that big pharma has no intent on curing cancer because they make much more money selling their ineffective chemotherapeutic drugs. We heard this 50 years ago for tuberculosis, that they don't want to cure it. That was the disease of the day. They don't want to cure it because they'll lose money. Nonsense. One thing about life is that you don't get out of it alive. If you cure one disease, there will always be some other disease to focus in on. So the argument is scientifically bankrupt that, you know, pharmaceutical industry doesn't want to treat or that doctors don't really want to cure patients. It just isn't true. And there's the anti-establishment rhetoric, you know, which implies that you know, nature is benign and you can treat diseases without drugs, without surgery, etc. And they have some very eloquent spokespeople on their behalf. Kevin Trudeau is a classic example. Kevin Trudeau is one of the biggest criminals of our age, but he's a very noisy criminal. He's on TV, he's on radio, he writes books. He has zero scientific training. He's got experience of all kinds, most of it acquired in jail, where he's been for credit card fraud. And he is the only person, and this is really something in the U.S., I mean, this is a record. He's the only person to have been banned by the Federal Trade Commission from doing infomercials on TV. Why? Because he defrauded so many people with his memory tapes, with his claims about coral calcium. He was banned. You can imagine what that is in the U.S. to ban someone from that, you know. But he's a clever crook because he's back now. You can't ban someone from writing a book, talking about a book. You can ban them from promoting a product for which there's no evidence. But you can express whatever opinion you want in a book, which he does. And this book, Natural Cures, they don't want you to know about. Who's the they? Us, the scientific establishment. Of course, we're trying to hide all of these natural cures. Has sold millions of copies, millions. I think now it's over 4 million. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for over 2 years. This single book is a testimonial to the failure of scientific education in North America. It is absurdity piled upon absurdity. Animals in the wild do not get sick, he says, of course, because they're eating natural foods. Cancer is caused by an acidic pH. Pasteurization kills living enzymes. Pretty hard to kill something that was never alive. Irradiation changes the energetic frequency of a food. I can't even begin to think what that means. He urges us to get 15 colonics in 30 days to clean out the toxins from our intestines. I hope in this case he follows his own regimen because there is a need for cleansing. You can change your DNA by thinking correct thoughts. And you can rebalance your body with frequency generators, whatever they may be. This is what people are reading, millions and millions of people. Then there's the introduction of pseudoscientific ideas. Homeopathy is one of these. I think that homeopathy is absolute nonsense, but I think homeopaths have a role to play, perhaps even an important role, which may sound somewhat confounding. I think a homeopath is a wonderful placebo. You go to a homeopath, they will spend an hour with you talking about every aspect of your life. And very often that's what people need because most diseases come and go. They get better no matter what the treatment is, often in spite of the treatment. And homeopaths cash in on that. People are often happy about their homeopathic experience as long as they really don't have any disease that they're suffering from. Let me give you a little background on homeopathy. Samuel Hahnemann, back in the 18th century, went to med school. He learned in med school exactly what you learned in those days, how to bleed people. That's a lancet. That's what you use to cut into veins. How to use leeches to suck the blood out of people and how to purge them. These were the medical treatments of the day, sort of the primitive version of get the toxins out of your body, right? Well, he thought that there had to be a kinder and gentler method about this. And he decided to investigate. Now, at that time, the bark of the cinchona tree was just about the only medication that worked against fevers, like malaria. But he wasn't quite sure what the dose was. Of course, they didn't have isolated quinine in those days. They just had the crude bark extract, which was imported from South America by the Jesuits, who had learned about it from the natives, called Jesuit powder, actually. And he was prescribing this bark, but of course with variable results. He didn't know how much. So he decided to test it on himself. And he began to take it to see what would be the ultimate side effect. And as he started to increase the dose of the cinchona bark that he was taking, he started to get a fever and the symptoms of malaria. And out of that singular observation emerged the theory of homeopathy, that a substance which in a healthy person causes the same symptoms that you see in a sick person will cure that sick person. However, he knew that he had been using this bark extract in his sick people at much smaller doses than what he was taking, And thus emerged the second tenet of homeopathy, that less is more. That the sick person has to be given less than what you give to a healthy person, and the drug becomes more powerful by dilution. An idea that is so scientifically absurd that it's hard to put it into words. It flies in the face of everything that we know about science, that something that is less will work better than something that is more. So he did these so-called provings. He started with Peruvian bark, the bark of the cinchona tree. He took it to see what it did. It caused fever, and therefore this became a treatment for fever. Then he looked at arsenic, and he started to investigate that on his family, friends, himself, taking it in increasing doses until he provoked a symptom. And then he cut back the dose, diluted and diluted it. Well, if you start taking arsenic, eventually you get gastric pain, vomiting, diarrhea. Of course, you stop at that point before you die. And then this becomes a treatment for food poisoning, because that's what has those symptoms. But of course, in an extremely, extremely dilute fashion. Okay. Then he looked at cantharide beetles or Spanish fly. And if you ingest these, it causes a burning of your genital tract, so it became a treatment for urinary problems. He accumulated all of this evidence in his Materia Medica, many, many provings. Simila similibus curantur, like cures like, was his anthem. And he started to carry out treatment based upon this. And people were happy. Of course they were happy, because it was a lot more comfortable than being bled or being purged. Right? So that was a major contribution. And he devised numerous kinds of homeopathic remedies. And in order to avoid having to give liquids, he soaked the diluted liquid into little pellets of sugar, which is, again, what they do today. Well, the law of infinitesimals is the way that he stated his case, which basically meant that as you diluted the thing more, it got more and more powerful. And then one day, when he was going to a patient in a carriage, he realized that the patient got better using the homeopathic remedy faster than his other patients. And it had been a particularly rough ride. The carriage had been vibrating on the stones. And he figured that this had somehow potentiated the medication. And thus was born the third pillar of homeopathy, the pillar of succussion. That between your dilutions, you must bank the drug into a leather pillow 100 times. And this is the way that it is still done today. The large homeopathic companies like Boiron in France have giant machines which do the dilution and the banking into the leather pillow, as incredible as that sounds. So the question, of course, is this dilution or delusion? Well, the argument that homeopaths use is that homeopathic drugs act like vaccines by stimulating the immune system. This can be dismissed out of hand because vaccines, of course, contain measurable amounts of an active ingredient. Vaccines give rise to an antibody reaction, which can be measured, and vaccines contain substances that are similar to the disease-causing agent, whereas in homeopathy, there's no relationship whatever to the disease-causing agent. Right? I mean, the diluted cinchona bark has no relationship to the parasite that causes the malaria. But of course, the interesting aspect of this, as far as we scientists are concerned, is that after dilution, there's not a single molecule left of the original substance. Hahnemann didn't know this. Why? Because in those days, they didn't know about molecules. So he had no idea of this. But today, homeopaths have us chemists breathing down their neck, saying, well, what's going on here? You know, there isn't a single molecule left. How do you explain the therapeutic effect? So they've had to come up with a rationalization. And the rationalization is that because of this dilution and banging into the leather, you leave an imprint of the original molecule on the solution, and it is that imprint which actually has the curative effect. Tough idea to sell to a chemist, but nevertheless, they try. Of course, I would ask them, how come that drug only remembers what you want it to remember? How come it doesn't remember all of the other substances that it encountered as it was flowing through the sewers? right? Or through the garbage or whatever. Why does it remember only what you have dissolved in it and want it to remember? And of course, they still have the idea that less is more. The more they dilute it, the most powerful it becomes. And therefore, the question comes up, what happens if you forget to take your homeopathic remedy one day? Do you overdose on it? Well, of course, the real question here is, what is the evidence? Never mind my meanderings through this complex web. Is there any evidence? Because maybe the theory doesn't make sense. That doesn't mean that we should dismiss it. And I think that's very important for us as scientists to point out that that's, you know, that's not fair, because we may be wrong about, you know, the theory, and the thing may really work. When radio was first introduced, engineers said that there would never be transmission from Europe to America because radio waves travel through straight lines and the Earth is curved. They don't travel through the ground, so we would never have transmission. Engineers said this. Of course, we have transmission because radio waves bounce off the atmosphere. Nobody thought about that. So maybe there is some other bizarre mechanism by which homeopathy works. That's why we ask the question, is there any evidence? Well, back in 1988, Jacques Benveniste seemed to have provided some when he claimed that with unbelievable dilution in his laboratory, he was able to provoke an antibody response. He was a well-recognized scientist. He was no quack. And he submitted his paper to Nature, which is one of the top scientific publications in the world, and eventually got published. However, there was a big guffaw about this, because when the editor sent it out to the referees, they said, you know, I mean, this makes absolutely no sense. This is ridiculous. But he's a reputable guy, and he says he found these results. So, you know, what are we to make of this? And Nature published a paper with a fascinating editorial reservation. It said that this flies in the face of scientific evidence, but who knows? And Dr. Benveniste has consented to have an independent committee come to his lab and investigate, which was the right thing to do. I mean, he actually believed that he had found something unbelievable. And a committee was struck. They investigated in the lab, and it turned out that the results could not be reproduced. And then Benveniste became self-delusional. He believed himself to be a Latter-day Galileo, as many of these people do, and that somehow the scientific community was refusing to understand what he had done. But the fact is that many people tried to duplicate the work, they couldn't. And that's one of the gold standards in science. Can it be replicated? If it can't be replicated, it isn't science. And he really became self-delusional. He came to the conclusion that you could even send homeopathic information through the internet, believe it or not. He would transmit data from his solution by email. And I mean, it sounds humorous. He actually believed this. And he did believe this to his dying day. Of course, this is goes without saying that this is irreproducible nonsense. It doesn't mean that we don't have the odd paper about homeopathy that shows a result. In this case, this particular plant did show a homeopathic result. How could this be? How could there be anything published in the peer-reviewed literature about non-existent molecules having some kind of an effect? Well, what we have to understand is that any time a scientific paper is published with numbers in it, there's always a certain uncertainty in it. Generally, what is recognized as the critical value in science is the so-called P.05 level, meaning that 19 out of 20 times, this result is due to some real experience. But 1 out of 20 times, it may be due to chance. I'll give you an example. If we had 100 coins, and we simultaneously flip them, what would we expect? 58, 42, 55, 45, 59, 41, that kind of thing, right? But if we repeated this tossing of 100 coins a few thousand times, one time you might get a 70, 30. If that's the only one you report, whoever reads that will think that you have a biased coin system. Well, you do enough experiments, and many, many have been done on homeopathy. Of course, sometimes by chance alone, you'll find positive results. And if that's the only one that you report, then it seems like there may be something to it. That's why what we do is search for a meta-analysis, a study of studies, which put together everything that is known. And in this particular case, dramatically published in The Lancet, looked at over 130 studies on homeopathy, and the conclusion was, when you put them all together, there is no effect there. Of course, you will talk to patients who swear that homeopathic remedies work for them. I suspect there's the placebo effect. If they're happy with it, that's fine, as long as you're not talking about a condition that could be serious, which might need conventional treatment, and you're not getting the conventional treatment. When you confront homeopaths with this, they come up with the lame excuse that homeopathy is not testable because it works by a different paradigm. I get suspicious any time I hear the word paradigm. You never hear that from legitimate scientists. It's always the alternative people. If someone makes a claim, it is up to them to prove that. Science cannot prove a negative. I can't prove to you that homeopathy doesn't work. I suspect it doesn't, but I couldn't prove it. I couldn't even prove to you that reindeer cannot fly. I suspect they can't. But if we put it to a test, if we took one to the top of this building and nudged it off, and let's face it, if that animal ever in its life were motivated to fly, that's the moment, we'd have a mess at the bottom. We could repeat it 2 or 3 times. We'd have the same result. What would we have proven? Is that those animals today, for some reason, could not or chose not to fly. There may be others. There may be 8 of them, which under the right conditions, the right stimulus, can fly. I cannot prove that. It's up to the homeopath to prove that it works, not up to us to prove that it doesn't. Applied kinesiology is as bizarre as homeopathy. This is not kinesiology that you may have heard of, where they actually have legitimate scientific training on muscle movement and work with athletes. No, this is different. If you go to an applied kinesiologist, as was recorded with this hidden camera in a store, they will investigate your weaknesses and what you need to remedy it. Put your little finger and your thumb together like so. This is the experiment. And then the kinesiologist tries to pry your fingers apart like this, which they do very easily. And then they tell you to extend your other hand, and they will put a bottle of something, one of their products, unopened bottle, on that other hand, and then try to pry your fingers open with great difficulty. Why? Because you need the product. Its very aura has strengthened you. Sounds funny. I assure you it's happening. It's happening in Montreal, in our health food stores, and in the offices of applied kinesiologists. And people will swear that they feel better after they've taken the medication. Even worse is pigeon therapy. This is not therapy for pigeons. Well, in a sense it is. The client is the pigeon, but this is very unfortunate therapy for the real pigeon. The therapist comes with a cage full of pigeons. I kid you not. The idea is that the disease is transferred from the patient into the pigeon. Again, this was done with a hidden camera. The pigeon is put on the tummy, in this case, of the person who was complaining of abdominal pains. The pigeon struggles. It doesn't like this one bit, as you might imagine. And then all of a sudden, it goes limp and dies. If the patient doesn't feel better, the pigeon is discarded and a second pigeon is tried. So you can have double or triple pigeon therapy. In this particular case, they used 4 pigeons until the patient said that he was feeling better. The pigeons did not feel better. The SPCA, at the very least, should be after these people. Now, thanks to videotapes, you can slow down the tape so we know exactly what is happening. The therapist has his thumbs on the pigeon's neck, and of course squeezes at the appropriate time, and the pigeon dies. The patient does feel better, I think. The placebo effect here is very powerful. The placebo effect depends on the kind of intervention. For example, it is well known that an injected placebo works much better than an oral placebo. A placebo where a pigeon dies dramatically is obviously more powerful than even an injection. But obviously it's a horrific and should be an illegal activity. The Cure for All Cancers by Hulda Rieger Clark, another book that has sold millions of copies. An amazing book. As you can imagine, the cure for all cancers, no mincing of words here. Her belief was that a parasite causes all cancer. It lives in our digestive tract, and if we eat the wrong foods, which are polluted with isopropyl alcohol, why she selected this particular chemical, I have no idea, but if you get isopropyl alcohol into your body, it happens to be rubbing alcohol, this releases this parasite from the digestive tract, it goes to your liver, and then all problems start. But you can circumvent this by going to Radio Shack and buying $35 worth of electronic parts with which you build this contraption, or if you don't want to build it, her company sells it for $250. It's called the Zapper. It can detect whether or not these parasites are ready to emerge from the digestive tract, that is, if you're a candidate for cancer, and it also can wipe out that cancer by generating frequencies that these parasites can't live with. So it can both diagnose and cure disease. It's sort of a replica in a more modern version of a device that was around over 100 years ago. When electricity was first introduced, you hold on to these electrodes, someone would crank the handle, you'd get a spark, which was supposed to drive the disease out of your body. Well, you get instructions with this zapper. First, on how to detect whether or not your household products have some of these nasty chemicals that will cause the parasite to be released in your body. Here's what you do. You put your product on one plate, and then you hold on to these electrodes, and you listen for the sound. And if it's a particular kind of static, then you know that that chemical, isopropanol, is present in that particular food. For example, she picks it up in all of these kind of things. And these are therefore toxic. These result in cancer. And then you have to cure yourself by matching the frequencies, listening to the frequency, and zapping it. If you have Alzheimer's, no problem. You can actually diagnose if you have Alzheimer's by taking a piece of brain. Luckily, you don't have to use your own brain. You buy a piece of brain in a store, put it on one plate of this instrument, put a piece of aluminum on the other plate because she believes that aluminum is the cause of Alzheimer's. The machine then tells, that tells the machine to look for aluminum in the brain while you're holding on to these electrodes. And again, if you get the right kind of static, it means you're a candidate for Alzheimer's. And then, of course, you tune in the right frequency and the problem is solved. And the instructions are all laid out there exactly on how to do this. And together with zapping the disease, you'll also take some cloves, walnut tincture, and wormwood because the parasites don't like those. So it's a double whammy. Amazing business, isn't it? Millions of people have bought that book. Desperate people abide by this. And, of course, she's got testimonials in the book about people who have been cured of cancer using her methodology. The only problem is that these are people that she diagnosed with cancer with her instrument. So they were cured of a disease that they never had. So not only is this a ridiculous, quote, cure, but imagine the fear it puts into people who believe that they have been diagnosed by this disease. She went on to publish other books, The Cure for All Diseases, and then The Cure for AIDS, which I guess is not a disease because it wasn't covered in Cure for All Diseases. And this virtuous lady who portrays herself as a godsend by, you know, to people who suffer from disease, passed away 2 weeks ago. You kind of hate to speak ill of the dead because we're not supposed to do that. Except that I think she was a cause of untold misery. Untold misery. Her death certificate, which we managed to get a hold of, She died of multiple myeloma, which is a cancer. So she was obviously unable to cure herself, or her brother, who also died of cancer. But I mean, this is belaboring the point. I mean, the thing is so absurd, hopefully everyone recognizes that it's such nonsense. I point it out because I think we should all realize that there are droves of people who buy into this stuff and whose life hangs in the balance in many cases because they're giving up conventional therapy. There's also misrepresentation of the efficacy and safety of the treatments that they engage in. For example, again, I get these all the time, these newsletters and whatever. They look very, very scientific. Here's one, a miraculous plant preparation that cures arthritis within days and makes drugs unnecessary, astounding treatment for Alzheimer's. I mean, all of these wonderful possibilities in this health alert briefing. It looks so scientific. It's got numbers on it. You know, it's almost like it was personally designed for you. And what they are very adept at doing in terms of maximizing the notion that the treatments are effective is taking things out of context. I'll give you an example. Dr. Victor Marchioni, who's a properly trained physician, and this is the worst, when a properly trained doctor goes astray because they have just enough scientific knowledge to confuse people. He says you can indulge in food without consequence, energize your brains and bodies without exercise, and live healthier without sacrifice. Sounds great. You can eat your smoked meat sandwich without having to worry about it. Who wouldn't like to do that? You can have delicious desserts and all of this. No? Well, where does he get such an idea? From Dr. David Sinclair, a top-notch researcher at Harvard. Dr. Sinclair has done work on resveratrol, which is the beneficial chemical in grapes and red wine. Very interesting science in there. I don't have the time to really tell you about it, but it's interesting science. And what he did was he took a group of rats, some of which were fed an outrageously high-fat diet. So they really, really expanded. But they were also given resveratrol. And the ones that got resveratrol got fat. But amazingly, even though they were on that high-calorie diet, lived as long as the skinny rats, while the fat rats without the resveratrol died sooner. And pretty interesting stuff, okay? So this is what Marchioni refers to. Takes things out of context. Tells about Dr. Sinclair and his research, which is, cutting-edge research. And then extrapolates and sells his own red wine pill. You can imagine how upset Marchioni is about this. There's lawsuits hanging in the air over there. Because who knows what is in this red wine pill? I mean, this research is still preliminary. It's been done on animals so far, not on humans. A human is not a giant rat in most cases, except for, obviously, Marchioni, who is. But then he goes on to, talk about how scientists now know why cholesterol, high blood pressure, heart problem, immune deficiencies never took their toll on the body of Jean Calment, who's the oldest lady. She defines the human lifespan at 122. And he says, well, it's because she drank red wine, and therefore you should buy his red wine pill. I mean, really silly stuff. She also smoked to the age of 115 when she gave it up because she said she wanted to lead a long life. Right? Okay, then. They also steer people away from possibly effective treatments using equipment like this. Looks very impressive, bells and whistles and lights. They measure electromagnetic energy and, unfortunately, tell people to stay away from conventional therapy. And this is not just hearsay. I mean, I've got lots of stuff in my file that I've personally collected from speaking to people who have actually been told and who have then gone on to physicians, unfortunately, sometimes too late. Here's one such case of a young boy here in Montreal who was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, which is eminently curable, but the parents decided to go the herbal route and put the kid on Matol, and by the time that it became evident that it wasn't doing anything, it was too late. And unfortunately, there are other cases like that. And finally, sometimes it's just a waste of money. These are ear candles. I suspect many of you have heard about these things. They're hollow wax candles. You put them in your ear. You lie down, you put them in your ear, and they light it. Of course, the end remote from the ear. And it burns down, supposedly sucking out your earwax and at the same time opening up your chi channels. And energy will then flow through your body, cure all kinds of things. Well, I went to one of these health fairs here in Montreal, and these are these big health food, health, you know, alternative medicine trade shows. I mean, it's enough to make you sick. Anyway, so I go in there, and I see the booth with the ear candling. So I say, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. $25 for the two candles. Okay, so I buy the two candles. I wait for my turn. I lie down on the table, and the lady sticks the candle in my ear and explains to me, you know, how this is going to work, how by heating up the air inside of the candle, you create a vacuum, and the vacuum will suck out the earwax, and you feel more energetic and all of this. So I dutifully, you know, hold my mouth, and I lie down, and she puts the thing in my ear, and we go through the whole experience, and it burns down till it's about this big. And then she unwraps it. The bottom is wrapped in aluminum to protect your ear. And she unwraps it and cuts it open and shows me the wax inside. Pretty impressive, right? Well, I knew I didn't have quite that much earwax. And I'd figured out by this time, of course, what was going on here. The burning candle dripped down on the inside of the cylinder and the wax solidified at the bottom. So this was just the beeswax that had solidified. Of course, I also knew that this idea about vacuum is ridiculous because you can take one of these candles and light it and see whether or not you can pick up a piece of tissue paper with the vacuum it generates. Of course not. There is no vacuum that is generated. Anyway, by this time I had enough, but I still had a candle left. So I decided I would put it to good use. Not whacking her with it, but I decided to do a little show for the dozen people who were waiting in line to be candled. So I stood there. I said, I'd like to show you something. So I took the candle in my hand, and I lit it without an ear attached. And we let it burn down till it was this big. And then we cut it open. I unfolded it, and there was the earwax, looking exactly the way that my wax looked. Now, I would think that that's a pretty interesting dramatic demonstration, right, of how nonsensical this is. How many people do you think got out of line? One. One got out of line. Why? Because faith is so important. I don't know what they thought. Maybe they thought that this was such a magical candle it could remove earwax remotely. It didn't have to be plugged in. I can't explain. So why the belief in alternative medicine? There's a frustration with conventional medicine, as I told you. There's a lack of understanding of nature of disease, that most diseases get better no matter what you do, in spite of what you do. The treatment gets the complement if you happen to engage in it. There's a lack of understanding of cause and effect. There's a tribe in Africa that believes that the roosters bring up the sun, because every morning they crow and the sun comes up. They are convinced that it is cause and effect. Try convincing them that it's not. See if you can design an experiment to prove it. You can't. There's a lack of understanding of the placebo effect, the tremendous power of the mind. The mind can overcome unbelievable adversity. There's a lack of realization that sometimes therapists will just say things that are simply not true. Christian Northrup, who writes many, many books, she's an MD, she writes many books on treatments, most of which are not scientifically founded, makes some absolutely astounding statements. Lou Gehrig's disease is a horrific disease. There is not a single person in the history of the world who has been cured of this disease. Karen completely cured herself of Lou Gehrig's disease by loving herself unconditionally just 15 minutes a day. I don't know what loving yourself means, but it may be kind of fun, but it is not going to cure Lou Gehrig's disease. This is an absolute absurdity. And of course, it gives false hope to people. There's a lack of understanding of the unreliability of anecdotal evidence. Just because something happened to one person and had a positive result doesn't mean it's science. The plural of anecdote is not data. For data, we need proper scientific studies. And just because it worked for one person doesn't mean that that is evidence. We require more than that. But to be absolutely fair, conventional medicine has plenty of skeletons in its closet too. It wasn't that long ago that doctors would send people into mines to cure them of their arthritis, to be exposed to radioactive waves, right? It wasn't that long ago that doctors advertised cigarettes. Camels were their favorite. It wasn't that long ago that after a heart attack, you would be put on 6 weeks bed rest. Or after cataract surgery, you had to lie for 2 weeks with sandbags around your head so that your head couldn't move. But the big but here is that science is a self-correcting discipline. And eventually, the truth will out. In homeopathy, they're talking about the same things that they talked about 300 years ago. There's been no progress. We no longer make people lie with sandbags around their head after cataract surgery because the evidence has shown that it is not necessary. That's what evidence-based medicine means. So let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, there may be some gems out there in that alternative world. There may be. There are some diamonds in the rough. But just because sometimes something is found, like the Helicobacter, doesn't justify all of the other nonsense. But I'll leave you with this final idea, just to show you that you can't really trust conventional science all the time either, until it does the right experiments, suppositories. Now, you look at a suppository, you would think that it is scientifically designed, right? The shape. Obviously, one end is pointed, that's the end that should go on first. But in evidence-based medicine, we say, let's test it. Because basically, that was a good idea. It seems logical. Let's test it. And now it has been tested. And it turns out that whether you put it in like that or like that makes a difference. And the difference is not what you'd suspect. It works better this way. Because when you insert that suppository and the sphincter muscle closes down, it closes down on the pointy end, it propels it in like a rocket. It works better, right? Now we have the evidence. Next time you have this issue, you can practice evidence-based medicine. But I leave you with this final observation. Nobody has a monopoly on the truth. Evidence-based medicine may not always work. But you know what? If you're a betting person, that's the way to bet. I also extend an invitation to you next Wednesday. If you want to drop over at 6 o'clock to the McGill Bookstore, my newest work, Science, Sense, and Nonsense, official launch. And the title says exactly what it is. And as you've, I think, heard here today, there's a lot of science and nonsense that is out there, and we have to make sure that we separate the two. If there are any questions, certainly. So let me hear about all the diseases you've been cured of by the therapies that I just dissed. Yeah.
Apparently, there's some evidence that certain things like cancers or heart disease, possibly even Alzheimer's, are the end result of bad treatment or neglect of earlier diseases. This is particularly true, for example, of liver cancer, where by the time you get the symptoms, it's too late to do anything about it. So my question is, how can you protect yourself as a kind of preventative thing in order not to have to get later onset diseases like that? I mean, it's a very large question, but I'm just wondering if you have any ideas on the subject.
Well, the first thing we have to recognize is that living is deadly, and that you don't get out of life alive. Eventually, something gets you. But, I mean, we'd all like to put off death to the very last moment, wouldn't we? All I can tell you is that we have plenty of evidence that a diet, proper diet, and exercise is the way to go. And if you can do your 30 minutes 5 times a week, and if you have a diet that incorporates 5 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and, of course, if you take the proper medical preventative measures, I mean, if you do the requisite checkups, that's what you can do. I mean, not everything is under our control. And, these days, of course, there's much more emphasis on prevention than treatment because it's much cheaper to try to prevent something than to try to treat it. But this is where we have absolute evidence. This is the combination of exercise and low-calorie, well-balanced diet. Amazingly, we have plenty of evidence now that caloric restriction makes you live longer. Of course, it's a miserable life. But, it's sort of like in order to live longer, you have to give up everything that is worthwhile living longer for. I can't give you more detailed answer than that. Yeah.
That was a great presentation. Thank you. I was just wondering what you think about acupuncture.
Acupuncture, I would not really put into the area of alternative because there is scientific evidence that acupuncture does work reliably for some conditions, certainly not for everything. Where there's plenty of evidence is in migraines, plenty of evidence. A Cochrane review, and Cochrane reviews are the most reliable medical reviews because they look into all of the studies, and it's quite conclusive that for migraines. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that every individual person will respond because you're always looking, at large populations. There's evidence that for certain kinds of localized pain, shoulder problems, elbow problems, yes. But acupuncture is not a cure-all. But nothing is. Antibiotics don't work for everything. Antivirals don't work for everything. It has its merits in a limited number of areas, but I certainly would not put it into the realm of quackery. I think the theoretical justification is unsound. The idea that, you're sticking the needles in to open up these channels, meridians, as they call them, which have no anatomical basis. But by whatever method it works, for those conditions, it does work.
Can I have one more question?
Have you ever looked into the, I don't know if you call it in English, like this back flower?
Yes, the back flower remedies. Very popular because, of course, flowers are all natural and they're pretty and they smell nice, so they should be good for you. There's absolutely no evidence that the back flower therapies do anything other than fatten the wallets of the people who sell back flower remedies. And, so much of this comes down to putting the burden on the promoter. Say, if you say that these flower extracts can do something, show me the evidence, or let's get together and let's design a clinical trial. But I can tell you again from many years of experience, they're not interested in doing that. Why? Because it can only turn out bad for them. You see, they already have the customers. The people who believe in the back flower remedies will keep buying it anyway. Why should they design an experiment that would conclusively show that it doesn't work?
Congratulations for your presentation, Dr. Schwartz. I'd like to ask you a question about naturopathy. Okay, a lot of vitamins, minerals are of natural sources, maybe better than synthetic sources because they're surrounded by
I know what you mean. Let me give you an example, which I think addresses the point. I said that we have plenty of evidence that consuming the 5 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day is beneficial. I mean, there's no contest there. The interpretation has been that it is because the vitamins or whatever other antioxidant we have in there, that's the reason. And one can, you know, rustle up all kinds of scientific arguments for it. The next step usually is to take those nutrients out of the food or independently synthesize them and put them in a pill, because North Americans love to guzzle pills. And invariably what we find is that just doesn't do it, because when these nutrients are present in the food, they have an effect for whatever reason, whether synergy with other substances in there, they perform differently from the extract. So I think in that sense, there is something to this whole idea of nutrients found together in a natural source being better. Now, that does not justify the concepts of naturopathy. And naturopathy, unfortunately, is quite loosely defined. It depends on where you are, you know, what a naturopath is. There are schools of naturopathy, which are 4-year schools, where you actually learn a fair bit about nutrition and health. But there are also people who just call themselves naturopaths without any kind of training whatsoever. So it's a real quagmire out there. Unfortunately, I think that the basic concept of naturopathy is that all diseases can be cured if you just give nature its proper tools, I think is flawed. I mean, that just is not the case. Not all diseases can be cured by natural means. But I will certainly agree that it is better to get your nutrients, especially your vitamins, from a food source than it is from a pill source. Now, that doesn't mean that the vitamin C in the food is in any chemical way different from the vitamin C in a pill. It isn't. I mean, vitamin C is ascorbic acid. It doesn't know if it was made by a chemist in a lab or by nature in a bush. It's exactly the same thing. But when it's present in the food, it may have a different activity because it works together with other nutrients that are present in the food, whereas if you take it out and you have a pure vitamin C pill, it may not do the same thing.
The second part of my question. The second part of my question is that there's a new issue. Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceutical has given this year prize to my organic teacher for is a synthesis of natural products made in lab. Mm-hmm. His name is Sylvain Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if they're going to be efficient because they're going to be concentrated or put it in a mattress like food.
Okay, no, this is, it is not, the. I mean, such prizes are not given because the synthetic product is somehow better than the one that you nature. It is because through the synthetic methodology, you may be able to produce it in bigger quantities or more cheaply. For example, vitamin C, which of course can be extracted from oranges, you can also make it in the lab from glucose through a series of steps. The end product is exactly the same, but you can produce it more efficiently and more cheaply by the synthetic route. So it's really the cleverness of the synthesis that gets the prize in such cases. Also, there are some compounds which are very rare in nature. For example, if you look at the yew tree in its bark contains a compound called Taxol, which is used in chemotherapy. It's a very effective drug. But in order to get enough, we'd have to wipe out all of the yew trees, you know. But now it can be made in the laboratory. And when you make it in the lab, it's the same stuff that you get from the tree. Okay?
I'd like to thank Dr. Schwartz very much for joining us today. And please, go to the book launch. I'm sure it'll be a very interesting book. I look forward to reading it. What better way to celebrate McGill's campus community than to have a star like Dr. Schwartz come and speak to us today? We're organizing more events next for next semester. We have a Magic of Chemistry show coming up. close to the holidays, which I'm sure many of you have registered for. We will have more lunch and learns, and we'd like to invite members of our community to join the campus community committee. If you'd like to do that or are interested in finding out more about it, please come and talk to me at the break or talk to Mira Turk or send us email, and please get involved. And thanks very much for coming today. Thank you very much, as always.